Two Jacksonville men freed from prison after more than 40 years behind bars. Just ahead, the story of their dramatic release. Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. Just ahead, we spotlight the mission of this area's Conviction Integrity Unit as we speak with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and Defense Attorney Hank Cox. And your calls. Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Then later, economic revitalization on the upswing in Palatka. We'll take a look at that, plus the Spectator's picks, her top five for this holiday weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, two local men, an uncle and a nephew, were recently freed after spending more than 40 years in prison for a murder. The evidence now suggests they did not commit. The release of Clifford Williams Jr. and Hubert Nathan Myers came about after an investigation by both the National Innocence Project and the local state attorney's office, Conviction Integrity Unit. This unit, which looks at questionable convictions, is the first of its kind in Florida and is leading the way when it comes to bipartisan moves toward criminal justice reform. We are taking a closer look right now at this dramatic case as we welcome Melissa Nelson, State Attorney for the 4th Judicial Circuit. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also here, Jacksonville Criminal Defense Attorney Hank Cox. Good morning, Hank.
Good morning.
And your calls as well. What are your thoughts about the release of an uncle and a nephew who were imprisoned for 42 years? Their convictions were vacated a few weeks ago. As we look at the Conviction Integrity Unit that helped bring this about, we want your calls at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaNJax, or weigh in on Facebook. State Attorney Melissa Nelson, let's begin with you. You began this new Conviction Integrity Unit to re-examine questionable cases that had been decided previously in this circuit. What was your motivation for starting the unit?
So I had read quite a bit about conviction integrity units that had been started in some district attorney's offices throughout the United States. Specifically, I think the first one was in Brooklyn, New York, and I had read about the DA there and his effort in standing up such a unit. And it made sense to me. In the private sector, there's quality assurance programs and audit programs in almost every industry and every space. But historically, in government and prosecutors' offices, there hadn't been. So the concept made sense. I thought it would be a very good way to demonstrate to the public and the community our willingness to look at ourselves, remedy mistakes if we should find any, and restore trust in the work that our good folks do every day.
And what led to the reexamination of this case, the convictions of Clifford Williams Jr. and Nathan Myers for a 1976 fatal shooting of a woman named Jeanette Williams and the attempted murder of her roommate?
So when we had the concept of conviction integrity, actually, the Bedell firm and Holland & Knight during transition hosted a meeting with the Innocence Project to think through how we could make such a concept come to life. I sat with the editorial board of the Florida Times Union, and Ben Carnark asked a question at the end of the interview: would we ever think about doing something like this? I said it would be great, but we didn't have the resources to do it. And that prompted us to go to our Florida legislature and seek funding. That also prompted a story that ran, and that story made its way to the Correctional Institute that Mr. Myers was incarcerated in, and he wrote our office a letter. That was 2 years ago. It took a year for us to successfully obtain the funding, actually stand the unit up. And so in January of last year, when the director was hired and Shelley Thibodeau joined our office, Mr. Myers' letter was among almost 100 other petitions that she found on her desk. We developed the protocols and the policies by which we would accept review of such petitions. And Mr. Myers' letter caught her eyes, and she began an investigation.
What are your questions for State Attorney Melissa Nelson? We'll go to your calls in a moment. The number is 549-2937. Also in studio with us, criminal defense attorney Hank Cox. And Hank, this is interesting to bring you into this discussion because you are well known today as a top criminal defense attorney, not just for Jacksonville, but also around Florida. At the time of this case, though, you were a prosecutor and you were involved in the conviction of these two men. You've also been involved in setting up, as Melissa said, this new unit. So I'm curious now, as you've reflected on this case, seeing these men now released, what are your thoughts as you look back on your prosecution back in the mid-1970s?
Well, I did prosecute these two individuals 43 years ago. About 4 years ago, I had the privilege of serving on the Florida Supreme Court Innocence Commission, and that commission identified the causes of wrongful convictions in the state of Florida, and there were, I think, 22 cases that they targeted to find out why they had been exonerated, whether it was misidentification, whether it was bad forensic evidence work, et cetera. And then after Melissa was elected, we hosted this event with the Innocence Project people from New York at our office, encouraging Melissa as strongly as we could, as Melissa said, along with Holland and Knight and Buddy Schultz, to set up a conviction integrity unit. I did not anticipate that the first case she would do would be the one that I prosecuted. But, you know, that's life in the big city. So,
do you feel now, in light of the new evidence, that they were wrongfully convicted?
I distinguish wrongfully convicted from innocent or exonerated or whatever. And I'll tell you exactly why. And it may be hair splitting and word splitting to a lot of people. And I'm sure it is to Mr. Williams and Mr. Myers that they could care less what I'm saying between exoneration, innocence, wrongfully convicted. I believe that the state attorney's position and the report fairly establishes wrongful conviction. I don't believe it establishes innocence.
Why not?
Because what this report does is deal with evidence that existed at the time, exists now, and how it was used. There are a lot of questions raised about the attorneys, what approach they made, strategy they used, et cetera. So all that added up can result in somebody being wrongfully convicted if the process wasn't fair, if the evidence presented wasn't fairly presented, et cetera. To say somebody is innocent is more along the lines of what you see with the exonerations of the DNA proof that Melissa Ross was not in Jacksonville, Florida on that day, but someone else was.
And this re-examining didn't involve DNA evidence, but let me ask you too. The convictions resulted in eyewitness testimony by a woman that testified that she identified these two men as the shooters. In the intervening decades since the 1970s, we've come to learn that eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable.
And absolutely.
Forensics technology has advanced enormously since the 1970s. So let me ask both of you this question. Given that these two men were released after more than 40 years, does it concern you that there may be other cases like this, men or women sitting in prison that were wrongfully convicted, given the way cases were prosecuted in decades past? That was the first question that occurred to me when I read about this story. How many more are there?
So the criminal justice system is a human system. It's I still believe the very best system in the world. But humans can make mistakes. And eyewitness testimony is incredibly powerful evidence. But it, like any other piece of evidence, has to be considered in the context of all of the evidence. Is it corroborated by the physical and forensic evidence, or is it not? And to your point, we have learned in the decades since the early 70s about the fragility of eyewitness testimony. Not to say that it still is not powerful, it just should be evaluated in the context of other evidence. And that's the goal of a unit like this and its work. And so if people from the Fourth Circuit make petitions to this unit and allege plausible and actual claims of innocence, I mean, that's, we've defined that very deliberately in our policies. And claims that can actually be substantiated or verified, then we will pursue an investigation.
And you're doing this, as you said, to work in part to restore the trust of the community. Under your predecessor, Angela Corey, this judicial circuit developed a reputation for, I think it's fair to say, being excessively punitive. And so do you see this as helping to restore public trust in the system?
I absolutely believe so. And I'm finding that just in since this case, everywhere I go in Jacksonville, and I think that comes just from any one person or any entity's willingness to self-reflect and remedy mistakes. So I hope that that is an outcome of this. I already sense that it is.
Hank Cox, are you concerned that there may be other cases you prosecuted or your colleagues prosecuted in the past that should be brought up for this type of review? Do you have guilt?
Do I have guilt? Well, in answer to the first part of your question, if the second case is also mine, I'm going to wring Melissa's neck. I'm going to tell you right now. But I don't think it's a question of guilt. I think Melissa says, and you learned about eyewitness identification, Florida leads the nation in exonerations of inmates from their prisons. The exonerations generally almost entirely stem from the DNA proof that the person could not have committed the crime, but the conviction arose from the faulty eyewitness identification in the first place. That's usually where the conviction, the wrongful conviction came from. So I agree with Melissa. You know, as far as confidence in the system, I think what she did in this case probably launched more confidence locally than anything that's happened in the criminal justice system in a long time. The willingness of the state to revisit something and say, maybe a mistake was made, let's correct it. Do I feel guilt about these things? If I did or I didn't, it wouldn't be on a radio show. It would be personal. So,
all right, let's go to your calls now. It's 549-2937. Daryl is in St. Augustine. Daryl, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. Well, congratulations to both the defense attorney and the prosecutor for visiting this, and I hope that they proceed a little bit more. The one thing I'll say, if Florida leaves the nation in exonerations, that must mean it leads the nation in wrongful convictions. So that's my first point. The second point is that when there is a wrongful conviction, the person that's convicted pays the price along with their family. When they discover that the conviction is not accurate, then there's usually payment made to the citizen, paid for by the taxpayer. The one person who doesn't end up holding any accountability is the prosecutor. Before reparations are paid to a citizen, I think it should be taken first from the prosecutor, or at least have some accountability to prosecutors, because he can prosecute or they can prosecute anybody they want. And if they find out 10 years later or 20 years later that it was wrong or it was vindictive or it was whatever, there is nothing to hold the prosecutor accountable for it.
Okay, thanks for that call. Melissa Nelson, certainly the one remedy people have to change out a prosecutor they feel is overstepping their authority is the ballot box. And we certainly saw that happen in Jacksonville with your election. But what about his question?
I want to be very clear that in this case, so Shelley Thibodeau, who's the director of the Conviction Integrity Unit, and her team spent a year looking at this, and they're is zero indication whatsoever that there was any prosecutorial misconduct at all. No violations of ethical rules, no violations of discovery rules or rules of procedure. And so to the caller's question about reparations or compensation coming from a prosecutor, that may be a discussion or a question better in the context of a case where a prosecutor has clearly violated ethical rules in order to obtain a conviction. And in this case, there's just absolutely no evidence of that.
No evidence of that. He brings up, I think, an issue that goes far beyond Jacksonville in North Florida, though, in that prosecutors, by and large, are they have enormous latitude all over the country in the way that they handle often controversial cases. And as I mentioned, the only mechanism to check what the public might see as a runaway prosecutor is to vote them out. And so your election in this circuit, I think, gained national attention because of that very dynamic. And so how much of a responsibility, I guess, do you feel to make sure that you are accountable to the public and you are restoring trust in the office? That seems to be driving a lot of your decisions.
It absolutely does. I talked a lot about this when I ran for office. Prosecutors wield enormous power and have tremendous discretion in every stage of the criminal justice process. And so we as prosecutors have to exercise that discretion and that power very carefully. And in order to be effective, we have to have the confidence of the people we serve. They have to trust that we are using our judgment in a diligent and very thoughtful way. And so I that message resonated with people throughout the election, and I see it every day in court. People expect law enforcement and prosecutors to follow the rule of law and to be aggressive and hold people accountable, and also, while doing so, to be fair and to play by the rules. And so I think respecting the power that the office holds and that this position holds is of tantamount importance.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with State Attorney Melissa Nelson and criminal defense attorney Hank Cox. After this circuit's new conviction integrity unit worked with the nationally renowned Innocence Project to release two local men from prison. They had been behind bars for 42 years for a murder, but their convictions were vacated after an investigation. We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937. And let me just get an email mentioned on the air. It's from Mark. He writes, "I changed parties to vote for Melissa Nelson, and I am so pleased with her performance. Juvenile arrests are down 35%, while recidivism has remained constant. Understanding direct filing of minors is the first step in the school-to-prison pipeline. Identifying the problem of human trafficking, and this too. These gentlemen owe you their freedom. Good job." And so this is a move that's won a lot of publicity and accolades, I think, from the public who followed this closely. And at the same time, Hank Cox, this listener talked about the change in the direct filing of minors and the school-to-prison pipeline. You were involved with that, with one particular case, a minor that was convicted of murder. You worked to have Christian Fernandez, who was 12 at the time of the incident that got so much attention, moved into the juvenile justice system rather than the adult system. That's just one example of the types of changes that we're seeing in our local judicial circuit that you've played a major part in.
Well, I think, by the way, he was not convicted of murder.
And, he was charged, yes.
He was charged with murder. No, I agree 100%. And I give Melissa credit for the focus her office and she has put on having mature, responsible prosecutors review these matters, as opposed to delegation to younger prosecutors who aren't familiar with the long-term ramifications of what it means to prosecute juveniles as adults. I think Melissa could tell better than I could how many people she has reviewing these cases and making those decisions to try to make the right decision on these juveniles.
So we believe that obviously certifying juveniles as adults and prosecuting them in an adult court is one of the most serious decisions our office makes. And so we need to treat those decisions with the seriousness that we believe warrants them. And so for that, I have two chief assistants, and every single juvenile who actually is transferred through a certification process to adult court is reviewed at the highest level in our office and by the chief assistant. Lee Hutton could speak very eloquently or has a command of all the facts of each of those cases. That's how important we are taking these cases. So they're not made across a variety of different lawyers who might have different sets of experiences or perspectives or even level of experience, but in fact, they're being made at the very, very top of our office.
AJ's in Daytona Beach. Hi, AJ. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question is, one of the gentlemen that was in jail for 43 years had a felony, and I think I heard under Florida law, he might not be eligible for respirations because of that previous felony. Is that true?
Thanks for that question.
That is currently the state of the law, yes.
So, yeah, he can't sue for reparations for his wrongful conviction because of this previous felony.
That's correct.
What do you think about that?
So I understand his lawyers are still putting together a petition to apply for compensation. Mr. Myers, however, is petitioning for compensation from the state.
And this is, correct me if I'm wrong, the longest two people have been imprisoned since the Innocence Project began its work some decades ago to try to overturn wrongful convictions. 42 years, is that right?
From what I've been told, I understand the same thing, but...
an incredibly long time. Okay, let's go...
Melissa, can I just add something?
Sure.
This case we're talking about with Mr. Williams and Mr. Myers highlights some other major problems in the criminal justice system, which would be peculiar to them, too. Number one, they were eligible for parole 18 years ago, but the Florida Parole Commission doesn't parole anybody for murder despite their eligibility. It just doesn't happen, which is wrong. People should be looked at individually and whether they're eligible. Number two, because of this tough on crime in the 80s and 90s, there are now rules that say even if they had this information that Melissa identified with her conviction integrity effort, they cannot bring up anything after 2 years have passed since their conviction was final. So they're essentially dead in the water with this problem. They couldn't do anything had Melissa not done that. The times had passed.
The legislature has made attempts at criminal justice reform. A number of pieces of legislation are moving or are being reviewed. There is movement in the direction of criminal justice reform in Florida. Still, though, you staking out this new unit is a first of its kind in Florida. Is it your hope that other circuits will follow your lead?
Certainly, because somebody who has a similar claim in Dade County, it makes sense, should be able to seek the same procedure that someone out of Duval County, such as Mr. Myers and Mr. Williams, were able to do. Tampa and Orlando have both established units. Our lawmakers, the legislature, saw fit to fund this effort, thought this was a worthy endeavor. And I do think that's indication of positive reform in the criminal justice system.
Mary in Jacksonville. Hi, Mary. Good morning. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I apologize. I was on hold. So if your panel's already answered this question about the Christian Fernandez case, would the new unit affect what some may consider over-prosecution in cases that have already been tried and sentenced? Would there be a review for that with this new unit or not?
No. Mary, thank you for your question. It's a great question. It's one, actually, that we spent a lot of time in thinking about how to develop the procedures for this unit that we discussed, because there are some conviction integrity units in the United States who are looking at disparity in sentencing or allegations of due process violations. Our unit is not. We are looking only at petitions and plausible claims of actual innocence that we can investigate and substantiate or not.
We're getting emails asking about other cases. Here's one from David. My brother was sentenced to 30 years for a minor nonviolent drug offense, even though the state recommended only 15. He has served 12 years as a model prisoner. Will the Conviction Integrity Unit help him? You just said no. But there are lots of cases like that where, as Hank pointed out, a tough-on-crime approach has people serving really lengthy sentences for nonviolent offenses.
Now, what the unit has done, because we've certainly, your callers have made pleas here on the show, we have received petitions about cases where people allege that their sentences were disparate. The review unit has denied those petitions based on the fact that they don't meet eligibility criteria. However, has looked at the cases in one case, for example, our unit realized that there had never been a motion for post-conviction relief filed in the matter, and so was able to direct the petitioner to avail themselves to that legal remedy. So while the unit is not accepting petitions to investigate absent allegations of actual innocence, mm-hmm. Shelley is, however, reviewing cases and alerting people to remedies that may be accessible to them.
And let me ask you, Hank Cox, you have a unique perspective on this as a former prosecutor who's now on the other side in court defending clients. What are your hopes for this unit over the long term?
Well, I would hope, and I think it probably will over time, accomplish the same thing that the Innocence Commission recommended, which is this laundry list of priorities within the Florida criminal justice system. Better training for eyewitness identification, better training in the world of forensics, better training in the world of interrogations, all those things. Because in this particular case that Melissa's talking about, there are a number of lessons to be learned. Now, the question becomes, how do you make sure people learn from it? That's the age-old problem.
So the other, Hank makes an excellent point. The other prong of our endeavor with conviction integrity is the training piece. So our unit will remain abreast on, just as we learn of the evolution of best practices in policing, that so is true in prosecution. And she is also responsible for training our prosecutors about how to be sensitive to fragility of eyewitness identification and the best way to ensure that an eyewitness identification is reliable. So the training aspect of this is particularly important. And I use the word autopsying a case where we know an error has been made, to share with our prosecutors, what can we do to guard against next time, ensure against the duplication of such an error?
Well, we thank you both for joining us. It's certainly fascinating to watch how this has unfolded, and we hope you'll come back and bring us up to date the next time the unit makes news. So thank you, State Attorney Melissa Nelson and Defense Attorney Hank Cox. And let me quickly mention, Melissa, you will be honored at the upcoming Children's Champion Luncheon by Episcopal Children's Services. That's May 22nd at the Downtown Omni Hotel. They just asked me to mention that, so I wanted to get that in. Melissa and Hank, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Still to come, Carrie Speckman's top five. But up next, revitalizing Palatka. Yes, Palatka. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Cypress Trust Company provides customized trust and investment strategies. It serves as personal representative or executor during estate settlement and as trustee for IRAs rolled over from qualified plans. Cypress Trust Jacksonville team is at 301-2222. Florida State University license plates support scholarships for students at FSU, a preeminent institution that enriches and contributes to the state and nation. Gifts for first-time buyers can be found online at fsu.edu/mytag.
The battle over Florida's so-called sanctuary cities. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
This Friday, while there are no official sanctuary cities in Florida, the legislature is looking at banning such cities in the Sunshine State. What does that mean for immigration here?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Friday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, small business owners are on the move in Palatka, a once struggling town in Putnam County, where a real revitalization effort is underway, both on the part of business and government. We are welcoming three female entrepreneurs behind all this right now. Realtor Roberta Robbie Correa, good morning.
Good morning.
Andrea Conover, she's the owner of Azalea City Brewing Company.
Good morning.
And Victoria McComb of Commonwealth Co-working. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, all three of you, for being with us. Now, the city of Palatka has been doing a lot in the way of grants and encouraging incentives to get people to invest in downtown. At the same time, business owners like the three of you have really been making moves. Let's begin with Andrea. You're the owner of Azalea City Brewing Company. This is a microbrewery in the old Coca-Cola building in Palatka, the former Coke bottling plant. What led you to do this?
Well, we're actually not open yet. We're still a brewery in planning. But I moved to Palatka a couple of years ago from St. John's County, Ponte Vedra Beach, actually. And I like breweries. I like how they help neighborhoods. And there was that beautiful old Coca-Cola building that's been vacant for a long time. And I was able to buy it. And Palatka needed a brewery. And I said, okay, if nobody else is going to do it, I thought I'll try it.
Microbreweries really spur economic development. We've seen that all over the country. So with your bold move in doing this, this could have a ripple effect in Palatka. Is that your hope?
Right. That's what we're hoping. Plus, we like beer anyway, and we're also going to have a restaurant and an event space, too. So it'll really help downtown Palatka, and it's a cute little town that I've come to know and love and want to help.
Victoria McComb of Commonwealth Co-working, you are making similar bold moves with opening up a co-working space in Palatka. Tell us about that.
Sure. So I'm actually kind of from Palatka. I graduated Palatka High School in 1997. And I decided, you know, last year to move back home. I've had a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. for about 6 years. And I decided to relocate back to Palatka, and the co-working space just kind of evolved out of that process because the real estate is super affordable. There are, it turns out there's actually quite a few remote workers in Palatka. And so we've kind of created this space where they're all coming together. We're collaborating around economic development. All of us are bringing, you know, businesses and capital back to the county, which is pretty incredible as well. And it's become kind of this space for, I think, entrepreneurship pollination in the downtown area.
And Robbie Correa, you're a realtor here in the group. Are real estate values moving in the right direction in Putnam County, in Palatka?
They actually are, Melissa. They are moving upward. It's a slow process in Palatka. Things do move more slowly there. But a lot of folks are moving from St. John's County, South Florida, and other parts of the country into Palatka. We have a lot of historic architecture that's still existent, probably one of the largest collections still existent in the state. We have that quaint little downtown situated on the banks of the St. John's River, and we have that ability for ecotourism, and if you live there, obviously, for kayaking, cycling, biking, kind of a complete streets kind of community. It's easy to walk to downtown.
It is a unique riverfront town with great historic buildings. In the past, it has suffered from economic stagnation. It's been overlooked. Mm-hmm. St. Augustine, Jacksonville, other cities have gotten a lot of the energy in the capital. But there's this kind of nascent movement to change that. and people are waking up to the opportunities there. Somebody with some moxie and some ideas can make a lot happen in a place like Palatka.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're doing with the microbrewery?
Right. I think so. And I think it all kind of feeds on each other, you know, with making different investments. And there's an old hotel that's been purchased recently that's going to be reopened, you know, renovated and reopened. And we have some other things going on downtown in addition to Victoria's co-working space. We have a yoga studio. There's a coffee shop. We have some antique stores, and it all kind of feeds on each other.
So what is your vision for Palatka? Let me ask all three of you that. How do you envision this city growing and changing?
I think there's potential for Palatka to become a remote working destination. It has a beautiful downtown, beautiful river. The cost of living is incredibly affordable. And we're really situated right in the middle of four or five major cities that are all kind of growing outwards and growing towards Putnam County. Mm-hmm. So as those people start looking for, you know, a more affordable cost of living, more, you know, exciting outdoor opportunities and things like that, my expectation is they're going to choose Putnam County in the future. And we want to be ready to give them some great experiences and a place to work and great things to do for their families.
And when you say the cost of living is affordable, let's talk about the cost of real estate in Putnam County as compared to St. John's County, for example,
almost,
which is right next door.
Or almost anywhere in Florida. So you can get a riverfront home at a very affordable price, probably I would say 50% less than any of those other locations. And a beautiful home, that, for example, right on River Street, which faces the river and includes property across the street on the river, there's a house for less than $500,000, a historic home, totally rehabbed. Those kind of prices mm-hmm. can't be met in St. John's or even Duval near the river or ocean or wherever. Mm-hmm. So they are extremely affordable. And for entrepreneurs that want to start a business downtown, the commercial structures, which are also zoned for multi-use and you can live above, are very affordable. And again, we're a community redevelopment area, so there are incentives available.
That, right. Now, let's talk about that. You're all business people, but the local government has been putting a lot mm-hmm. of incentives into play. How is that affecting things?
I think it's having a positive impact.
Mm-hmm. I did get a grant for the brewery from the city of Palatka with the community CRA. What does that stand for?
Redevelopment Agency.
Okay, and that made a difference, mm-hmm, obviously, mm-hmm.
That,
right?
Yep, that helped, definitely.
And you know, with co-working, too, today people can work almost from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so in your co-working space, what are some of the businesses that are using this space? Or do they come from mm-hmm. locally, or are they coming from other states, other countries?
Yeah, it's a it's an interesting mix, and it's kind of a mix I wasn't expecting when I first returned home. So we have an international tax accountant who I just listened to all day on Monday, uh-huh. calling five different countries to help, you know, solve some international tax issues. We have a vice president of a software company from Gainesville who uses our space to kind of go back and forth and pause in between. We have a young entrepreneur who has a business in Gainesville. We have a residential contractor who uses the space. So it's a variety of businesses, and it's a mixture of locally owned and then also remote workers who are still working for companies outside of Putnam County or outside of the state.
It's interesting to know for people listening that have never been down to Palatka or Putnam County that the history of this town is actually quite fascinating. In the 1800s, it was a major tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know that. Then with the growth of St. Augustine, that sucked a lot of the energy away from Palatka, didn't it?
Yes, particularly when Henry Flagler started the train line on the East Coast to go further south, and it kind of was the death knell for the riverboats, steamboats that did transport people. But in Palatka's heyday, there were over 5,000 accommodation spaces. So the rich and famous used to come and stay in Palatka.
Yeah, spend their winters down here.
Spend their winters down there. Yeah.
There's still a charming historic district in Palatka.
There are two.
How much is that driving? There's two, I'm sorry.
Yes.
How much is that affecting or working in in tandem with these revitalization efforts?
I think it's a big piece of it, again, because those communities allow people to walk right downtown. We also have a lot of retirees that move to Palatka and want the amenities of a downtown, and they are kind of demanding that, and I think that will lead or spur more entrepreneurship downtown. But you can walk a bicycle to those downtown, to the downtown districts from both those neighborhoods, historic neighborhoods.
What's still missing from Palatka? What businesses would you like to see that aren't there now?
Everybody wants a bakery.
A bakery. Yes,
a bakery. Yes, a bakery.
I want gelato, personally.
Yeah. Gelato would be good.
You think a bakery would be successful?
I do, actually.
Yeah. I think it would be. Other community, we have our bigger grocery food chains out on the highway, but we really could use a little market downtown, a grocery, fresh produce market, local produced edibles.
And you're about to get a microbrewery. So tell us a little more about Azalea City Brewing and its planned opening and what people can expect.
All right. Well, we're planning on opening this fall, or at least by the end of the year. And we'll have a brewery and a tap room open in phase one. And phase two will be that restaurant and event space. And we have a brewer. He's already working for us part-time, Eli Miranda. And he's awesome. And he's brewed 11 different kinds of beers so far. We don't have our license, so we haven't been able to sell our beer yet, but we give away samples.
Is it called Azalea City Beer? What's it called?
Azalea City Brewing Company.
But that's what the beer's called, too?
Well, we've made 11 different styles.
Okay.
So we've had an IPA and a pale ale and a red ale and a chocolate stout, and our hot blonde is real popular. It's made with mango and local dattel peppers.
Nice.
So we call it the hot blonde, and made a chocolate stout, a pumpkin ale, and just, you know, like most craft breweries, just different styles and see what people like. We'll have light beers also, and, you know, the different darker beers, and just we'll serve wine and soda and maybe kombucha also for people who don't want to have craft beer.
Let me ask you as a follow-up question. For all of this revitalization that's happening in the attractive real estate prices, how much of a hindrance is growth in Putnam County due to the perception that it doesn't have a good school system? And how much would a better public school system help with the growth that you're trying to see happen in Palatka?
It's definitely a factor, particularly obviously for couples with young children there, and with St. John's right across the border, so to speak. Obviously, they're going to make that decision. I think that's kind of why, at least from the real estate perspective, I've focused on retirees, thinking that that will bring the revenue in to improve the school system, which is a time, you know, will take time to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
But it has been a factor, yes, and it has contributed a negative image to the community.
And I would just add to that it's definitely on the agenda, top priority of the local leadership, and they're working very, very hard to improve the school system. So it's
yes,
something I think everybody is very aware of and working really hard to improve.
With all of that said, when can people come out to the grand opening of the brewery?
Hopefully October, November.
October, November.
Frame. Yes.
That's a good time of year.
I think so. I'd love
to drink some beer.
Oktoberfest, you know.
Sure.
So, yep.
Well, kudos to all three of you as we shine a spotlight on growth in Palatka. Thanks for joining us, Realtor Robbie Correa. In studio, also with us, Andrea Conover, who owns Azalea City Brewing Company, and Victoria McComb, who owns Commonwealth Co-working. Thanks for being with us and driving up the road to Jacksonville to hang out here.
Thanks so much for having us.
And in a moment, our top five picks for your weekend from The Spectator. Next, we'll be right back.
It's baseball season, and on the next Fresh Air, we learn about fastballs, curveballs, screwballs, and spitballs from New York Times national baseball writer Tyler Kepner. He talked to hundreds of pitchers about what they throw and how they try to get a mental edge over the hitters they face. His new book is K, A History of Baseball in 10 Pitches. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Years ago, when he was a kid, a guy created a superhero, and now, lo these many years, that idea is an Amazon series.
It's not easy to hang around. It's easier to just sort of fade out because there's so much fatigue.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, The Tick, and it's Return to the Small Screen, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
Writer-director Nia DaCosta goes from indie to big budget.
I think when you write what you know emotionally, you realize that what you feel is felt by a lot of people, and that's actually what connects us.
That's DaCosta on her new film. Plus, we're covering the release of the redacted Mueller report. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Twenty years ago, the shooting at Columbine High changed America's awareness about guns and safety in schools.
It turned from, like, flirting screams to terrified screams.
We went to bed that night not knowing if Daniel was dead or alive.
A special collaboration with Guns and America on those who made a difference then and now. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, of course, the Kentucky Derby is just around the corner. It's always held the first Saturday in May. You can celebrate the Derby at a lavish affair, a Derby evening under the Oaks. Yes, the Root Ball is coming up. Greenscape of Jacksonville is hosting a Kentucky Derby-themed party at the beautiful Boeing Oaks Plantation. Here now with more, Anna Dooley of Greenscape of Jax and Robin Patton, who's heading up the Root Ball. She's with Late Bloomers Garden Club. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
You guys both wore incredible hats into the studio this morning, which is super exciting because what's a Kentucky Derby party if not having tons of fabulous hats? Anna, this is going to be an incredible event.
It is going to be great. And thanks, by the way, for starting with the old nag. Yes, and Melissa, the hats are going to be really important with you because you are one of our judges.
I am very excited and a little nervous to help judge the Bodacious Hat Contest at this shindig.
Well, we'll have a female winner, and then we'll have a gentleman winner.
The men are going to wear hats, too?
Well, I don't know, but I'm sure they'll be in something outstanding because they're the ones that preen all the time. So we will have a prize for them as well.
Okay, Robin Patton, you've been doing incredible work putting together the Root Ball. It's going to be at a venue people will just be blown away by. The Boeing Oaks Plantation, right?
I think it's actually Bowing Oaks.
Bowing Oaks, pardon me.
Down in Bayard, actually. It's not very far. It's breathtaking. The first time we went down there, we pulled up, and just the oaks, the venue, outside, indoors, it's just beautiful. We're so excited about it. And we're going to start out with watching the Kentucky Derby.
Right. Watching the Derby. Well, there'll be the hat contest. You're going to have mint juleps, music, dancing, silent auction, all kinds of fun stuff. This is all to support Greenscape of Jacksonville, which has done so much work to preserve the lush tree canopy in this city. Anna.
Thank you, Melissa. Yes, we've been around since 1975, planting, protecting, and promoting trees. And this is our only fundraiser of the year, and we're really, really grateful to the Late Bloomers Garden Club, who produce this event for us every year. It's going to be fantastic.
This is coming up, as I said, the first Saturday in May, May 4th, at Bowing Oaks Plantation, the Root Ball. How can people get their tickets, guys?
Easy. Actually, you can go to the rootball.com. And we actually, this is the first year we're offering a young professional 35 and under ticket, which we're hoping to attract young professionals who want to give back to the community. And we have a wonderful group, the River City United Foundation, who's been plugging and promoting it for their young members. And we're hoping to get more young people involved in Greenscape because it's so important
it
in
is.
The community.
So get your tickets now. Discount if you're 35 and younger, too. Go to therootball.com. Anna Dooley, Robin Patton, I'll see you there.
Thank you.
And that's May 4th. Finally, this hour, we have lots of ideas for this holiday weekend. The Spectator is here, Carrie Spegman, to count down her top five events over the Easter Passover holiday. Good morning. You're going to begin with, I think, an Easter-related event.
Well, if my phone would pull up, I would be happy to tell you all about the Easter keg hunt.
I have a script here for you.
You know me so well, ma'am.
We're short on time. Number five.
Easter keg hunt is Jacksonville's best adult scavenger hunt. You solve clues. You will learn history about Jacksonville. Costumes are encouraged. You check in at Springfield. Krispies.
Number four,
Earth Day events. There's a million of them. I want to pick just one. But it, actually, Earth Day is on Monday, but there are a lot of events on Saturday.
Number three.
Mandarin Art Festival.
Oh, yes,
there
definitely.
There are more than 100 artists, I believe. They have Kids Zone and vendors and a green market.
Number two
is Collective Con, which is the largest pop culture convention in town. They have five actors from Game of Thrones. I'm not even attempt to say their names.
But they will be there, so go out to Morocco Shrine.
As well
Shrine.
As Flash Gordon.
Oh, fun. How fun is that? And number one.
The School of Rock.
Oh, very nice. The musical.
I saw it last night. Super fun. The kids are so good. It's really good.
People that've seen the movie with Jack Black, that story on stage.
Exactly. And he's really, the lead guy is really good. It's very good.
Oh, wow.
Two thumbs up.
Yeah, two thumbs up for that. Go to thespectator.com for Carrie's top five picks. Get out and enjoy the weekend. And ladies, thanks to all three of you for being here today. Have fun this weekend.
Pleasure and an inconvenience.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. We'll be back tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great Thursday, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.